You are listening to the Middle East Institute's podcast series. To support MEI's programs and podcasts, please donate at www.mei.edu. Thank you for your support.
Good morning. I would like to welcome you to the Middle East Institute's panel on preventing violence in the name of God, religion and diplomacy in the Middle East. And I would like to issue a special welcome to our C-SPAN viewers this morning. This is the second in MEI series on diplomacy and religion. The first we held a month ago featuring Cardinal McCarrick and Ayatollah Iravani taking up the topic from a religious point of view. And today we take it up from a diplomatic perspective. Things have changed regarding religion and statecraft in U.S. diplomacy, and particularly in the Department of State. Madeleine Albright records in her memoirs, The Mighty and the Almighty, many practitioners of foreign policy, including me, have sought to separate religion from world politics, to liberate logic from beliefs that transcend logic. This attitude contrasts sharply with Secretary Kerry at the launch of the State Department's Office of Faith-Based Initiatives. He admonished, "We ignore the global impact of religion at our peril," and told Foreign Service officers, "Go out and engage religious leaders and faith-based communities in our day-to-day work." At a time when religious violence inflames the Middle East, the question of how diplomacy and religion can interact takes on a high operational importance. What is the Department of State doing to fulfill Secretary Kerry's instructions? What are the scope and the limits of cooperation? We are honored this morning to welcome our panelists. First of all, Jerry White to my right. Jerry is the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of Conflict and Stabilization Operations. And I have to say, a leader in landmine, what do you call it, removal. An unconventional diplomat. Also, Arsalan Soleiman, the Deputy U.S. Envoy to the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, and it's a tribute to his commitment that he is taking time off from paternity leave after being a father for now 1 week. So I'd also like to welcome Ambassador Tom Pickering, whose very distinguished diplomatic career includes ambassadorships on almost every continent except, I believe, Antarctica. As well as being Under Secretary of State for Political Affairs and U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. Jerry will speak first and give the general outlines. Arsalan will speak next and fill in about the OIC. Ambassador Pickering will provide commentary at the end. So, Jerry, the floor is yours.
Thank you and welcome. Thank you, Ellen, for the kind introduction. It's actually a very exciting time to be at the State Department, working particularly on this issue of the nexus of diplomacy and religion, as well as conflict. As you heard, I'm the Deputy Assistant Secretary for the newest bureau at the State Department of Conflict and Stabilization Operations. And it was launched under Secretary Clinton as a new bureau to develop, as you heard, non-traditional ways of engaging on issues of conflict prevention, mitigation, and also crisis response. So as we see around the world, there's plenty to do. The question is how to pick which battles and how to proceed. It turns out that one of them that I think was prescient for Secretary Clinton and now Secretary Kerry was the issue of religion and diplomacy. And I would say that this year, 2014 to 2015, may become known as the year of religion and conflict and diplomacy because it is front and center on every newspaper. As you're reading it, people are confused of what is religious violence? Is there such a thing? What's really the source of the underlying conditions for violence? When is religion serving more as kerosene or a match lighting and accelerating or causing a viral spread of violence? what are we seeing happening in the Middle East, for example? Is this something new or old? So when I first came into the State Department nearly 3 years ago, this was starting to percolate. Secretary Clinton had started a strategic dialogue on religion and diplomacy. And I was charged with chairing a working group on religion and conflict mitigation. Actually, when I first came in, quite frankly, someone gave me a bucket of books and papers and says, Jerry, you love this stuff. Why don't you take it over? And I thought it was interesting. There was sort of a cultural bias against taking on religion, as you heard from the quote from Secretary Albright's book. It was the third rail you weren't supposed to touch. So there we were with a basket and lots of ideas, but people understanding we had to tackle this new issue. So the issue was a bias, I think, in terms of culture. Because of our establishment clause, as you understand, and the perception of separation of church and state and the reality of what that would mean, most people just wouldn't touch religious engagement. It just was one of those things, don't do it, we aren't allowed, or go to the legal office at State Department, in a sense, get permission to engage. So this was a challenge for world diplomacy when you find out that actually 85% of the world are religious or function out of sets of beliefs and rituals and practices. So not even knowing that language, not being able to engage at that most fundamental level is a challenge. So the question was, how does one really understand the separation of church and state and the Establishment Clause as it applies to our role in diplomacy and representing the U.S. government abroad? So religious engagement has become the new hot topic, it turns out. The second piece that was a challenge was finding out that after 9/11, the concept of how to engage became a little, perhaps, instrumental. You know, after 9/11, how do we engage with, you know, Muslims who hate us or like us? Or a vocabulary of terrorism and extremism was attached to and muddled the religious dialogue. So the concept was more utilitarian. There are good partners and bad partners, and somehow we were in the business of judging who on the scale was moderate or extreme, or who we could actually engage with. This was another challenge to overcome, or an obstacle to, I think, healthy dialogue that we had been wrestling with as well. And the third was basically just the capacity. We found that, in fact, the Foreign Service Institute had not actually had lots of training of our diplomats in faith-based engagement or in religious sensitivities. I think there was an optional class of 4 days maximum or maybe 4 hours en route to Afghanistan or Iraq or wherever you were going to be stationed next. So looking at that dearth of training materials was a challenge because, in fact, there wasn't religious literacy inside the U.S. government and among our diplomatic class for the most part. As well as just this idea of where do you go to in the State Department? It turns out there were different people working on pieces of this. So Secretary Kerry came in and actually moved very quickly to launch the first sort of faith-based community initiatives office and assigned a special advisor, a senior advisor, Sean Casey, to help navigate this space. Because up until this point, there was another issue in terms of who to call. People went to the Religious Freedom Office, and that's one of the very important strands of our engagement policy and what we do at the State Department, but it's not the only thing. So what has happened is the White House and the State Department have done a complete, I would say, U-turn or 180-degree shift in the last year in terms of religious engagement, and they set up, you know, three major lines of effort and three working groups to accompany them. Number one is how to partner with religious communities around the world and in the United States on issues related to health, development, and humanitarian assistance. That's one big strand. The second is, as I just mentioned, religious freedom, human rights, and pluralism. How is it that protection of minorities and religious groups is in the category of religious freedom that we have been standing for, you know, since our founding? And third was the working group that I co-chair related to conflict mitigation. So that's where we stand. There's been a change. There have been new case studies coming forward, and we set out to look at new training materials that are now being finished up after a year of work that I think may not be perfect, but may be among the best that are out there in terms of diplomatic training on these particular issues of biases, stereotypes, establishment clause, but also how to navigate religion in conflict zones. So one thing to keep in mind, and perhaps we could discuss, is how is it that a religion or religious language can manifest itself in conflict? And therefore, how do you engage with different groups who might be in a different phase of their religious formation? Or, for example, if a group feels under existential threat, the language they use that may be more exclusivist or fear-based, black and white, could shift sometimes to a call to violence. But is it going to be violent? Is hate speech, no matter how despicable, going to trigger violence? We're now just learning at how to look at language usage in ways that could show or indicate that violent behavior could be coming. It doesn't mean that someone expressing themselves on social media or elsewhere in hateful ways are going to be violent. So our job at the Bureau of Conflict and Stabilization Operations is to look at that space of violence, not necessarily the space of free speech and religion, but it's important to track language. Other language on the other end of the spectrum might be, as they call, normative or textbook language. You might be an Episcopal priest, or you might be a faith-based organization like World Vision, and you may use faith-based motivated language, but in fact you function just like an NGO, almost along secular and humanitarian principles, but your values-based and your belief underpins that work. How to engage on that end of the spectrum is another way to look at things, another approach that in fact is sort of what most embassies would be used to working with, Catholic Relief Services, Islamic Relief, and others. So, and there's everything in between. After a war, for example, in a conflict zone, religious groups may be in a period of questioning or recovery or wondering how to find their way and navigate the reconstruction of their country and of their communities after violence. So that's another space of engagement, which is more, one might say, almost like trauma recovery after war. How is it that your humanitarian work, your community-based outreach can minister to your communities in ways that are open and ripe for a partnership and with the United States, with other governments and other partners locally? So all of this just gives you a flavor of what has been happening at the State Department in terms of policy. What is actually the intention on the ground to work on these three main issues and working groups. And I think actually, lastly, I would say that the working group that we're working on right now is looking at the possibility of a global covenant, using sort of some religiously infused language, because the Prince of Jordan and the King of Jordan have asked for a response from the United Nations, but also world religious leaders, including the Pope, Archbishop of Canterbury, and others, to take a look at how do we respond to the type of violence that we're seeing that seems that it's politically and religiously infused. You know, what is it about this language, and what can we do to protect belief, protect practices, and also protect sort of groups and even sacred sites, for example, that are trigger points and flashpoints for violence. So I would say the Global Covenant Initiative is being looked at by the working group because it's not generated or started by the United States, but we would like to track it and understand how to work and lead from alongside our colleagues around the world in the Middle East and elsewhere on looking at this new challenge of religiously motivated or related violence. So there are three, I'll close with the three pieces of this. One is just the interreligious leadership. What is it where iconic or religious elders can gather together, almost like Pope John Paul did in Assisi, pulling people together, religious leaders from around the world, to renounce this collective violence in the name of God or mass killing in the name of religion? That is something that non-state actors and leaders have to address, even outside the nation-state parameters of the UN, for example. So one movement is at that highest level of religious groups talking to each other and developing some declaration. The second level is, as I mentioned, the UN level. Nation states have laws and policies against genocide, violence, and other norms. But something different seems to be entering in, which is violence against religions themselves, not just individuals or human rights violations, but groups and their practices and their beliefs and their gatherings, their cemeteries, their sacred sites. So the UN would like to look at the ISIL question as illustrative, but also Boko Haram, wherever we're seeing extreme violence being conducted in the name of religion, what can be preventative to stop that and inhibit that or contain it, but also when is it actually a crime against humanity? These are new international issues that are coming up that are not just nation to nation, but also dealing with non-state actors who are committing atrocities. And lastly, NGOs around the world have been on the front lines doing this work for some time, and they have many best practices, you know, countering violent extremism, as well as promoting resilience and religion with its positive role. People know a lot about that, and violence takes place at a communal level. So this third level is intercommunally. What are the best practices? How do people build neighborhood to neighborhood, the type of resilient fabric that prevents and protects against future violence, whether reconstructing after war or just to prevent future conflict between religious and other communities. So that's a lot, but it is to say that in the last couple of years, and quite, as Alan mentioned, quite a significant shift in how the United States government and our allies are looking at this issue and based on lessons we've learned from the past. So thank you for your attention and interest in the topic.
Thank you. I'd like to also thank the Middle East Institute, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, for organizing and hosting this panel, and also for Alan and for Jerry and Ambassador Pickering for being here on the panel with me today. Jerry gave much of the overview of a lot of the changes at the department, and I just wanted to add one small thing to that, which is to highlight the role that the White House strategy on religious leader engagement played. In 2013, the White House issued this strategy, which is meant to promote government-wide greater engagement with religious leaders in the three areas that Jerry outlined. So it's not just the State Department, but it's also meant to affect our Department of Defense, USAID, and other actors who are engaging in foreign policy work and diplomatic work in order to encourage them to also engage with these communities who are playing, as Jerry mentioned, a very significant role in the world. And if we ignore them, we ignore them to our peril. I want to spend my time in my remarks just talking a little bit about some of the work that we've done out of the Office of the Special Envoy to the OIC, Organization of Islamic Cooperation, as a little bit of an example of some of the ways that we have engaged and worked in collaboration with religious actors in order to promote some of the goals, including some of the goals that Jerry talked about. Some of you may not be familiar, but the Office of the Special Envoy to the OIC was established at the end of the George W. Bush administration, and President Obama appointed Special Envoy Rashad Hussein to the position. And when he did so, he gave him the mandate of deepening and expanding the partnerships that the president announced during his Cairo speech. And as you probably remember, the Cairo speech went through a whole litany of issues, sort of the hot topic issues that have been problematic in terms of U.S. relations with the Muslim world in general. And so these cover things from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan to counterterrorism policies to human rights issues to democracy promotion, all of these issues. And so our office has worked on a lot of different areas, but one of the areas that we have been working on in particular is to engage with religious communities and religious leaders in our work in order to include them because of the significant role that they play in general and also in particular in Muslim societies. So one example that I want to give, which touches a little bit on what Jerry was talking about in terms of the role of the UN and how religious communities sometimes define themselves as a group, is an initiative that we worked on that dealt with the issue of defamation of religions. Some of you may be familiar, but beginning in 1998, the OIC had advocated a resolution at the UN on the so-called defamation of religions. It was a resolution that essentially was calling out a lot of the hate speech or discrimination or Islamophobia that many people were identifying in the post 9/11 years in particular, but even before that, because this resolution started in 1998, before even 9/11. And the idea behind it, in part, was to address discrimination against people on the basis of religion. However, the problem that the United States had with this resolution was that it went a step further. It talked about banning speech and restricting speech and other statements or criticisms that you can make about religion. And that was problematic for us for a number of reasons, but in particular because, you know, freedom of expression, we believe, is an extremely important human right. And we believe that restrictions on freedom of expression not only restrict human rights in that sense, but also they infringe on individuals' ability to exercise their religion freely. So for a number of years, we had been working to essentially, you know, defeat this resolution at the UN. And when the Obama administration came in, we took an approach that was also working to defeat the resolution, but also to work with the OIC on potentially transforming the resolution into a positive. Because we shared some of the underlying concerns about discrimination, but we did not agree with the means. And so in 2011, we worked on an alternative to that resolution, which passed by consensus in the UN, and it's been called Resolution 1618. And that resolution essentially focuses on positive actions that governments can take to address religious tolerance, things like enforcing anti-discrimination laws, education awareness programs, engaging with religious communities, all of these kind of proactive, positive measures that we practice in the United States are listed in this resolution. And we've been working ever since 2011 on promoting implementation of that resolution. And one of the key ways that we've been working on this is with religious communities and religious actors. So as you're undoubtedly aware, this resolution on defamation of religions, it lines up, or some governments were using that as a way of justifying or providing cover for domestic blasphemy laws. Those laws are often abused or used in ways which target religious minorities, which often end up justifying communal violence against religious minorities. And so one of the key efforts behind the 1618 effort was to move past that and also to get governments to move away from that. And so religious communities and leaders were important both domestically and internationally in our engagement in order to explain to them that we understand your concerns about hate speech that might be directed against your religion, but the way that this type of approach tries to address that goal, in fact, doesn't actually work. Bans on speech often increase the attention that people give to that that speech, and often it's used to repress religious minorities. Sometimes you're a co-religionist in different countries. And so we worked on explaining this position not only with governments and with the OIC directly, but also with the religious communities, and their support was important in order to convince various communities and countries in the alternate approach, the 1618 approach. And their support has also been important in the implementation process. We have initiated a training program since then to work with interested governments on the specific activities that we outlined in the resolution. And we have also had a series of meetings which are focusing on best practices for implementing those goals. And the last meeting of which was held in Doha. It was organized in part by the Doha International Center for Interfaith Dialogue with the Qatari Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And the focus of that meeting was on collaboration, interfaith collaboration to protect religious freedom. So you had their human rights advocates, you had members of religious communities, religious leaders, and government officials all together working on the same shared issue. And it was very interesting to observe because that grouping of individuals don't often get together. And so it was a nice way of using this initiative to convene a lot of the actors who share the same goals and try to direct them in a way that you know, they can work together on shared policy initiatives. Another way that we've used religious engagement is to open new channels of communication. Through our office, we often are visiting OIC member countries, and as you may be aware, many of them have been going and are still undergoing democratic transitions. In Bahrain in particular, there have been a lot of sectarian tensions around the transitions that are happening, or the national dialogue and the democracy movement there in that country. And so on one of the visits, we used our office in order to try to expand the lines of communication that the United States has with actors in Bahrain. Our government has often met with the opposition party leadership, the Wafaq leadership, But up to a certain point last year, we had never met with the spiritual leader of that group, Ayatollah Isa Qasim. And we took the opportunity for one of the visits of Special Envoy Hussein to meet with that religious leader in order to explain to him directly U.S. policy in the country, and also to explain our concerns that we had about certain groups that were engaging in violence. And so through that activity, you can kind of open a new relationship with a religious leader to explain to them our positions and also to express concerns that we have, concerns that were also shared by the government of Bahrain, and to do so in order to promote the national dialogue and other collaborative efforts that were happening on the ground. Finally, not to take up too much time, but I wanted to mention one other initiative that we have been working with religious actors on, and that is an initiative that a number of religious scholars, in collaboration with the Islamic Society of North America, had developed or worked on, which is issuing a declaration on the rights of and the protection of full citizenship rights for minorities in the Muslim world. You know, in our work in the OIC, I think anyone who's been observing this space can see that there is a very difficult and ongoing problem of violence against religious minorities, particularly in the Middle East and OIC countries. And that was something that we've talked about a lot in our efforts, in our engagements. And this initiative was a way of the religious leaders and the community to try to address that. And so there have been meetings by these scholars, and it's not just the scholars, but also ministers of religious affairs from various countries in the Middle East and North Africa who've attended these meetings, where there have been substantive discussions on a framework for a declaration, including based largely on a well-researched paper on the Islamic basis for protecting religious minorities, which was authored by one of the most influential scholars in the Middle East. And so we've been encouraging these actors to continue with this project and are hopeful that it may be concluding by the end of this year or early next year. But this is another example of where we're not directing any actor to do anything. We're not, funding anyone to do anything, but we are engaging on shared goals and engaging in a way that, respects these leaders and the authority that they carry, and encouraging them in certain ways that also lines up with our goals. So with those examples, I'll turn it back to Alan.
Thank you very much, Arsalan.
Thank you, Alan, very much for gathering us, and it's a pleasure and an honor to have the opportunity to say a few words after the distinguished speakers we've already heard. Thanks to the Middle East Institute and to Carnegie as well for helping us put it all together. My sense is that this is both a new and an old venture in the inevitable relationship between religion and diplomacy. I thought that Jerry's approach of seeking three areas, or the department's approach through Jerry of seeking three areas within which to work, makes a great deal of sense. Certainly what one would call the broad spectrum of humanitarian work by religions around the globe has always had an appeal, a sense of contributing to the common good, and a feeling of what I would call satisfaction that it transcended theological differences and put into place the values that are widely shared among religions that in themselves contribute to a more harmonious and better globe. I think the notion of dialogue between religious leaders and between religious leaders and thought leaders across the spectrum is extremely important. And another way of emphasizing those portions of religious activity, which I think epitomized in the first effort through plans of action, can be epitomized in the second effort through plans of coordination and indeed plans of mutual information and plans of dealing with problem areas that inevitably have come up in the difference between belief systems. And I think the third area is very important, and perhaps before I finish, I'd like to spend a little bit of time on that, conflict resolution. I say this against a backdrop of something I hadn't realized until I actually sat and thought a little bit about it as I was doing an oral history long after I retired from the State Department. But I had a unique position of being an ambassador first to a Muslim country, a largely Muslim country, Jordan, but with an important and significant Christian minority. I then went on to Nigeria, where, in effect, two great world religions, Christianity and Islam, had advanced a great deal down the road of conversion and proselytization, done so, in my view, with reasonable harmony at the time I was there, but left a lot in many ways in the hands of traditional African religion, and indeed themselves were heavily influenced by African religious practices. And so while homosexuality is anathema among Nigerian Christians, polygamy is widely winked at. And in many ways, the edges of Christianity and the edges of Islam are touched heavily by the development of syncretic sects, combining, in effect, traditional religious ideas with those of the mainline religious communities to which they attach themselves in one way or another. And it was an interesting and indeed somewhat eye-opening experience. I then went on to a largely traditionally Roman Catholic country, El Salvador, but one that in many ways in the throes of liberation wars and theological conflict among the majority was also undergoing a change in the influence of evangelical Protestantism within the community, and where the religious leadership was split down the middle and played an enormously valuable role in some ways in bringing things together, and a divisive role in others by failing to recognize what I would call the transcendental values of the principal system that made things work. I went from there to the world's only Jewish country, Israel, and from there to the United Nations, which is everything for everybody. And I was delighted to see from Arslan new information for me on the work being done in the context of the United Nations, which has to skirt, obviously, the very difficult question that we Americans have to skirt. How do we differentiate between faith-based belief systems, which Protestants largely consider to be individual, and the absolute need to develop communication and indeed understanding and cooperation on a world scale? And so what you're undertaking is challenging in many ways. Clearly, it is not the role of diplomats or, in my view, the role of world leaders to help redefine theological concepts. It is the role, however, for all of us to try to bring together those who think and work in the realm of theology around the areas where they can find agreement and help them in their definition of areas of disagreement, hopefully, first, to do no damage, and secondly, seek the seeds of commonality wherever they might exist. I went from there to the world's largest Hindu country. You may say the only one, but Nepal also fits that model. And that, too, was fascinating. I was there only a short period of time, but it was extremely interesting the degree to which, despite the predominance of Hinduism, Islam, Sikhism, Jainism, many other religious experiences, including the birthplace of Buddhism, played a role in Indian thinking and Indian ideas. And indeed, India has had its long history of both common working together and terrible devastation as a result of religious differences, not any different from those differences which historically have transcended, put it this way, political harmony in the Western world for thousands of years and which diplomats have to deal with. And then finally, I went to Russia. Then and still the largest Eastern Orthodox Christian country, but one until just a few eye blinks before I arrived was totally committed atheist. And in many ways, these experiences as a diplomat meant that inevitably I had to deal with the patriarch, with the archbishop, with the mullahs. Without doing that, I couldn't understand what was happening more or less unable to help to try to make a contribution to dispute settlement. We American diplomats, in some ways, are saddled by invisible handcuffs that over the years have served us well, but always need to be reexamined. One of those, which is a handcuff that we all share, is that we cannot operate outside the Constitution, the law, the regulations, and the policy. And we must serve those interests. We have the privilege of seeking to change the latter, and indeed the task of doing so when it's inadequate. And we have the right to change the law through our elected representatives, and indeed even the Constitution with its own processes. The second invisible handcuff is we don't do domestic politics. And in my view, that's extremely important. But I found that the higher up I got in the State Department, the more I had to take it into account. There was no way to convince a president to adopt a foreign policy initiative I was interested in if, in fact, it was completely antithetical to his domestic political success. That's a reality, but it is a fancily hard one to deal with, and we must be conscious of that as diplomats. And the third was religion. And here we tended to take the constitutional barrier to establishing state religion as a broader barrier against even involving religion, thinking about religion, or talking about it. And in many ways, of course, it was the basis for harmony in this country that we did not use in whatever ways we could avoid it, religious differences as a source of both political and personal gain. And in many ways, that holds true. But it is also true that we have to face up to the reality that we live in a world of a large number of faith-based systems which influence greatly how people operate. So as a diplomat in dispute settlement, I found it was increasingly important, first and foremost, to understand those particular faith-based systems as much as I could. Secondly, to communicate with the leadership in those systems as to how they saw the kinds of issues that I wished to deal with as a diplomat. Thirdly, to see how the conjunction of views could be used as a basis for harmonizing and moving processes ahead rather than agitating and dividing them. There is no question, of course, that each of the major religions has what I would call its fundamentalist wing. I saw an old friend, the Prime Minister of Israel, assassinated by a co-religioner on what were clearly religious grounds. We have seen among Christians the use of violence in this country to destroy people associated with our government because of apparent religious beliefs. And we have seen as well in Islam, a late manifestation is what we call ISIL, or what my friends in the regions call Daesh, Dalit al-Islamiyya fi Iraq al-Sham. And to some extent, this presents us with special problems, which we do need to understand, but it was never absent from our military engagement in Iraq and Afghanistan over the last 10 years. It is in many ways, too, the problem we must continue to work on and try to solve with our friends in Israel and the Arab world, particularly Palestinians. It's extremely important. The Gaza truce is broken down again. We need, as a first order of business, to continue to work on it. The last effort with the help of the Egyptians made some progress in the areas of what I would call fundamental change on both sides. We need to find a way to link that particular set of processes to the longer run requirement that we continue to push and do everything we can for the two-state solution. And I admire John Kerry, even in the aftermath of what is an apparent failure to succeed that he's prepared to take it on. And I don't think he's given up, obviously, the notion that this is still a major challenge for us, and we have to work at it. And being able in many ways to solve the problems, which are now a mixture, obviously, of fear, a fear of annihilation on the part of many, a sense of concern about ethnic and ethnic religious identity and how that will be respected, and a competition over that most fundamental of human goods beyond, put it this way, salvation land, and how and in what way people can live together in differences and at the same time enjoy the value that religious promises that harmony will bring to us as we go ahead. Syria and Iraq are the centerpiece of these issues. And unfortunately, in my view, widely informed, if I can use that expression, by a heavy emphasis on religious differences, which over a period of time, given goodwill, and one would hope wise, informed, and confident leadership, could become the basis for change, and indeed rather than the basis for further radicalization and destruction of human life. And we need to accept the challenge that we as a major player in the world scene have of contributing in whatever way we can to the answers to those problems. I agree with the president that boots on the ground has not turned out to be a very good answer to differences, whether they are religiously inspired, motivated, or informed. And we need to be careful about that. But I think there are ways ahead. We now have a world in among our friends who speak Arabic of turmoil and difficulty, of change that has come about in large measure through dissatisfaction, I think mainly with secular approaches, but in some cases with religious approaches. And we need to first understand that question, and secondly, decide how to deal with it. As a diplomat, we never have perfect options. We are always saddled with dealing with people whose frailties we understand, maybe even disdain and would like to change, and have very little possibility of doing that, but who we have to inspire, obviously, to greater accomplishments, if I can put it that way, through personal motivation, through long-run interests in their own value system, and indeed through the opportunity to make a contribution to their federal man, which in my view should be the highest good, but often it's the worst danger. So there are plenty of things out there for us to do. A failure to understand how important religion is in these conflicts is the first point of error. The other point of success is to know and indeed cultivate the relationships that can begin to take common understanding forward to make those changes. And I think that the notion that Senator Kerry had, that it is time in an organizational and institutional sense to put the State Department on that path in a serious and open way, is very important and very valuable. We need to avoid the traps and pitfalls, obviously, of going too far into theology and perhaps too little into peace. But if we can keep those two points in mind, I know we will have success. And I'm very pleased that Jerry and that Arslan are making their own personal contribution to this effort. I compliment them for taking on these tasks and thank them for doing so. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Pickering. And in some ways, I would like to take off from what you just said to pose some questions both to you and to Arslan and to Jerry. I mentioned in my remarks that the Middle East is inflamed, and in many cases, the Beirut issues are religious issues. So the diplomacy is sometimes at the high level that you've talked about, but quite frequently it's how do you get people to stop killing each other over religious issues, whether it's in Iraq or Syria or Bahrain or so on and so forth. So what is the contribution that your work can make to resolving the very issues that Ambassador Pickering talked about? And maybe you two could talk first, and then Ambassador Pickering, maybe you can sort of give your own thoughts. Jerry?
Sure, thank you. I guess to get a little more specific on strategies to prevent this sort of mass or religiously infused violence, we need to come up with some case studies. So starting at the bottom-up approach in terms of intercommunal work and understanding, I do think religious literacy is not just needed for our diplomats, but also on the ground where communities don't understand the other very well, and so it's so easy to demonize the other. So just recently, I've been working and examining the role of scriptural reasoning in this work of increasing tolerance and respect for difference. And it's one way that has been largely tried among the or between the Abrahamic faiths to have groups study their scriptures together from the Quran, New Testament, Torah, whatnot, and to have mixed interfaith groups looking at interpretations of passages, even related to violence and tolerance and peace. And what happens in the course of the group study is a dialogue and a relationship building that, in fact, can be seen to reduce prospects for violence. Let's say, for example, I go into a textual study and I believe as a Christian that you're, you know, bound for hell. And I might actually feel that I'm under threat and I must push you there. Some people have taken their scriptural passions to violent ends. In the course of study, you can start to learn with textual reasoning and deeper understanding of text that you may still think they're going to hell, but you don't. Can't, there might be some interpretation or some wiggle room there about what is the exclusion or the need for action. And in that course of just opening up anyone's mind to the possibility that there might be another interpretation of text, not just a literal one of this particular text, we have seen that groups have become more tolerant and started to build relationships. And that can take place in the course of 4 hours, 4 days, 4 months, 4 years. But in fact, people are looking and scanning the globe for techniques that actually get at religious literacy as well as relationship building at the community level. And scriptural reasoning just happens to be one of them that's being used out there. At the community service level, I think that's another area people have to look at. I think Ambassador Pickering was right. The humanitarian the collective action around issues of water or safety and other things is another way to get interfaith groups just working together and serving the community. It builds resilience. So there's a new initiative to save the Jordan River, for example, where it's understood that all the faiths value creation, but the particular iconic river, Jordan, is at risk of dying. You know, it's basically running out of water, filled mostly with sewage, surrounded by minefields, and one could say is a victim of conflict. So interreligious groups will take common cause and say, well, how do we save the river? How do we work on issues of water and environment together? And that's another way of building relationships and fabric on issues of common concern. And then additionally, I think we've seen it with Rashad Hussein and as Arslan said about his office, when atrocities have broken out in South Sudan, in Kar, and elsewhere in the world, we have dispatched diplomats and tried to pull together religious leaders to go on the site and try to work with local religious leaders. We're seeing it in Nigeria. We're seeing it in a lot of cases, but it's been done almost at an ad hoc level. We don't have the capacity to create a mediation team that's literate in religion and religious engagement so that it can be more effective. So the UN could also look at what would a rapid response mediation team look like that in fact is in this category of religious engagement. How does one do that? Not just here and there in reaction to crises, but from an ongoing capacity, whether at the UN, the US government, or among faith-based organizations. So this would require diplomats and religious leaders working more closely together to learn each other's language of conflict resolution, as well as scriptural and faith-based reasoning. So those are three examples.
Jerry, before we go on, I'd like to understand, the Department of State already has sort of an emergency reaction religious mediation team?
No, that's what I'd say. I would like to bring the build the capacity. Rashad Hussein, as a special envoy, has been dispatched with others to do this work and to good effect. So what's interesting is when we see this working, people speaking their own language and being able to engage with religious leaders successfully, we should be doing more of it and scaling sort of a cadre inside the U.S. government and internationally to be able to do this.
Arsal?
Yeah, if I might add, just to build on that, I think, you know, obviously every situation is different and you have to understand the context of a particular conflict. In many cases, religion is not actually the source of the conflict. It just happens to sometimes overlap with the political lines or other, you know, economic or whatever factors are driving that conflict. So to say that, you know, a certain situation is religious violence really sometimes, you know, it kind of mischaracterizes the situation and glosses over a lot of the underlying factors. So that's important to recognize, because when you intervene or when you engage with actors on the ground who are, whether they're a party to the conflict or not, but they're affected by the conflict, the role that they can play is important. So, for example, Jerry was talking about dispatching delegations. One example of that recently was in the Central African Republic, where, you know, the State Department's assessment is it's not a religious conflict per se. It's a conflict that's being driven by various political factors and other factors, but there is a lot of overlap in terms of religious lines. And so, you know, back in April, Rashad had visited Bangui, the Central African Republic, and he brought with him religious leaders from the United States, Cardinal McCarrick, Imam Majid, and Leith Anderson, representing, you know, the Catholic community, the Muslim community, and the Protestant community. And they met there on the ground in Bangui with religious leaders who had already been working together to promote peace and to end the violence between the communities. The Archbishop of Bangui and the leader of the Muslim community, the head imam there, were working together, and various articles about the impressive work that they had done trying to promote peace and trying to prevent their communities from being sucked into the violence that was going on there. And so the idea of sending this delegation was to highlight the efforts that these religious leaders were doing already on the ground and to try to provide them with some solidarity and support from co-religionists or other religions or religious groups, members of religious groups who are interested in helping in that situation. And since that delegation visited, some of the members of the delegation have gone back. Some of the groups that they're affiliated with, like Catholic Relief Services, have increased and tailored their assistance in certain ways. There's one group that was, you know, part of the delegation, the Network of Traditional and Religious Leaders, that has visited a couple of times, and they're working along with other international partners, including the King Abdullah International Center for Interfaith and Interreligious Dialogue, the OIC, and the Doha International Center for Interfaith Dialogue, on promoting intra-faith mediation amongst the Muslim community in the Central African Republic, which was divided by some people who were you know, in favor of working with the Christian communities towards peace, and some groups who were essentially writing off those efforts. And so as a result of that delegation, there are mediation efforts at the intra-religious level as well. So that's just one example of how you can have sort of an external intervention which can bring parties together, and you know, those parties might have different resources that they can bring to bear on the situation and try to help promote some of the efforts that are already ongoing on the ground. And one other thing I want to mention as well before is a lot of the situations that we're facing right now, where there's conflict with the element of religion involved, it's often a case where you have kind of a minority interpretation or a minority group that is claiming to speak on behalf of the larger religion. And the majority of those, you know, co-religionists or people who follow that religion feel that their religion has been hijacked by this group and has been misinterpreted or has been, you know, abused or taken advantage of. And that's just not just for Islam, but I think you see that in certain cases in Burma and Sri Lanka, where you have Buddhist communities who there are certain groups that are promoting violence in certain ways and other kind of co-religionists who are, you know, not supportive of that. So in those types of situations, I think there's another set of tools or factors that can be employed in order to highlight the voices of the mainstream members of those communities, or the religious leaders who represent most of the members of that religious community whose religion may be abused in certain ways. An example of that recently is in Nigeria, where you have Boko Haram essentially organized around a particular ideology. I mean, they're essentially a mafia group run by this guy who's claiming to act on a religious basis, but it's completely not a religious basis. And there are religious leaders throughout Nigeria who at a time were speaking out very openly against Boko Haram, but over the years were targeted for assassination and other intimidation by this group, and so their voices were kind of silenced. And so one thing that we tried to do at the State Department after the kidnapping of the schoolgirls was to have kind of a video conference where we, through our embassy, had a lot of the senior religious leaders in the Muslim community, via video conference link with some of the religious leadership in the U.S. In order to ask them, what kind of assistance can you get? We know that you've been speaking out on this group, but what can you do? And so the State Department convened these individuals, and then they have gone on their own and are now trying to organize an international conference where you have international Islamic leaders assisting some of the Nigerian Islamic leaders on raising their voice to counter groups like Boko Haram. So that's just another example of how, in this situation of violence, the government can use its convening authority to bring people together who are, share the same goals, and hopefully we can help, the situation on the ground.
We've heard a lot of wisdom from the two speakers, and I have little to add. But let me say a couple of things. One is that most conflicts are immediately distinguished by the we-they syndrome. The we-they syndrome then seeks to develop all of the rationale, all of the logic, all of the illogic as to why the conflict should be perpetuated and that my side should win. And it is in that cycle that historically religion has played a large role, or a role as an additional identifier, or as a role for rationalizing a point of view in one way or another. It is also clear that the conflicts are often over other questions. That is, that the primary intention of religion X is not to convert everybody in religion Y. It's to resolve some other problem, a conflict over space, a conflict over doing business, a conflict over running a country. Many of these are power-centered in their own way. And therefore, religion in an interesting way can play a remedial role as well as an aggravating role, particularly the more the leadership vests itself in the clothing of religion, the more it should be susceptible to religious interpretation to help resolve the problem. At least one can start with that presumption. Next, there are two or three levels where this can work, and you've heard examples from us of all of them. But one of those is interreligious dialogue, using religious leaders and their influence as a major way to affect the movement of the problem toward resolution, whatever that might be. It's been an interesting in the history, or put it this way, the history of non-American Iranian relations, that to some extent, the religious differences have been high. On the other hand, particularly on the Iranian side, the respect for religious leaders from the other side has been well above their tolerance for the political leaders on the other side, in part because of a feeling that people of religion, maybe people of the book, have enough in common to be able to bridge the differences, and they share some common sense of value, some common sense of devotion to a deity that they can see as having a common, put it this way, role and interest in their religious lives. And that's important. The second is obviously how those in the political sphere, the diplomatic sphere, can be informed and make effective use of their understanding as a way to bridge the differences, whether it is with the help of religious people engaged or on their own, or basically with counselors from the religious side. And that itself is extremely significant and very important. And the third is because the public always plays a huge role. Much of what is done in, put it this way, agitating and making worse foreign affairs problems is done in the name of domestic politics, unfortunately. We may say democracy is simply splendid, and I agree it is. But democracy, put it this way, informed by people committed to the wrong values, is as hard a problem as autocracy, where the leadership tends to want to say to you, my people won't go for this, I can't sell it. So in both cases, we have a common issue. And if, in fact, the public believes, put it this way, myths, lies, falsehoods about the other side, then you have a huge problem in trying to work with that. And if that has a religious quotient, and it often does, even if it is only a common set of broadly accepted moral values, almost all of which stem from religious tradition, then you can use that as ways to find your way through the situation. I think you've described those all. We've talked about them, but it's an effort to give some structure and context to these things that I say what I said.
Questions from the audience. Who would like to be first?
Back here.
Thank you. I'm Leon Weintraub, follow me with the Foreign Service right now with the University of Wisconsin. I'd like to follow up on some of the remarks of Mr. Suleiman, who was speaking about Boko Haram, but also expanded to the Islamic State. And I'm wondering if you think it would be appropriate, helpful, and possible if authoritative Islamic leaders who could speak on a global stage would issue some kind of statement or doctrine that's saying people who use the tactics of the Islamic State or Boko Haram are completely off the reservation, don't represent the Islamic faith, and should be shunned or declared as heretics or whatever would be appropriate. And if, in fact, it would be appropriate, helpful, and possible, is there a role for the U.S. in that?
Arsalan, I think you were fingered, but maybe the others would like to take a question back at it, too.
No, absolutely. There have been such statements. The OIC itself, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, had a very strong statement kind of rejecting what ISIS has claimed to have established and the group in and of itself. There have been a number of international Islamic scholars who have also issued statements directly condemning the group and rejecting their claimed establishment of the state. There's an International Union of Islamic Scholars that has a number of senior scholars that are members of it. That organization issued a statement, and other international personalities have also issued such statements. So I think there is, or there has been, those kind of statements out there, not just on ISIS, but also on other groups like Against Al-Qaeda and Boko Haram and others. We just don't necessarily, I guess, get reporting on that as much, or, you know, the media here may not highlight it as much. But I think those statements are certainly there, and that group, I mean, that position has been expressed by some of these senior leaders.
Do you have any comment, Jerry or Tom?
And just really quickly.
Do you know what Arsalan said about the lack of knowledge in this country is a serious issue. In many ways, we don't hear much of the good news, particularly from the Islamic side, as to how, put it this way, mainstream leaders in Islam treat the particular problems. And it has been a problem before 9/11, but it was certainly seriously aggravated. My greatest fear at 9/11 was not another attack. It was that we would launch a war against Islam. And President Bush shared that, but were never quite capable of taking it fully into account, I think. But I've been very concerned about that, and to some extent, it's true that the Christian denominations in the United States are unaware, practically, of what's being said. And for the first time, Arslan here has put it out in its various manifestations in a way that is easy to understand. But you wonder why, in effect, we have the ideas that we have. And I think that partly it is ignorance about what else is going on in other parts of the world. And we're marvelously served by a highly competitive press whose principal interest is bad news.
Jared? No, I think that question begs another one, which others might have commentary on the role of media in this. So I think media, like religion, can be remedial or aggravating, to use Ambassador Pickering's words. And what is it about it? So again, what is the parallelism of just a communication channel called religion and religious leaders and groups, or media, social or traditional media? And so when we are seeing the viral spread of ignorance or lies or misinformation, what does one do about that when you also are balancing the free speech and allowing the internet to be the internet? So these are very serious questions for us, because people are starting to fight their battles with rather violent language online, and people tend to use different types of media. For example, there was a recent study I was being briefed on related to, you know, extremists and exclusivists who tend to be violent prefer YouTube and the graphic nature and the fear factor that can be generated by showing very awful pictures, as you've been seeing, of beheadings and killings and mass shootings that sort of move a certain direction. And then on the other end of the spectrum, pluralists, or those sort of nice people who want us to all live together in love and peace, tend to just retweet, use Twitter to retweet positive news stories. So it might be something, you know, in the middle of a concert and a call to prayer with Justin Bieber, you know, he'll interrupt the conference and you wonder why that goes viral online. But those are retweets, and they tend to be like nice pluralists who want us all to get along. And then in between, there's the crowd that you might call more tribal or ethno, you know, or nationalist, who tend to use, you know, Facebook and blogs like NGOs. So one has to look at how the continuum of religious-based actors and politically motivated actors, power actors, are using media, and how is it that we have a strategy on that front to counter viral spread of violence online. And lastly, I think it just raises this question, too, of what the positive nature of religion. How is it that the silent majority, you know, those who are lovers, not fighters, who want to sort of live peaceably and respect the dignity of difference of others, how is it their voice can be encouraged to be amplified? Not as, you know, classing them as moderates. You know, I don't think you'd like to be called a moderate friend if you feel that you're actually a devoted friend or a devout person. So this language of just inviting people to take a stand for something, your faith, resilience, peace, and the protection of belief and communities and practice, and also a stand against something, which is things that are beyond the pale. And I think it's interesting this week to see a religious leader, you know, the Vatican and Pope Francis, taking a stand and saying ISIL's behavior is so beyond the pale that, in fact, it does justify military action. That's a very strong and probably unexpected statement coming out this week.
Thank you. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. My name is Hassan. I was born in Tehran, and I have an organization by the name of Global Bridges for Humanity. So nice to see you, Tom, and Arsalan, and Jerry. And there is a lot of talk, and right now, in a place called Manassas, there's a mosque that was vandalized a couple of days ago. And I don't know what information has been already printed. Everybody knows about it or not. This mosque particularly is open to all faiths, Christians, Jews, Muslims, and they have dialogue all the time, and they were vandalized this few days ago. And we hope that the public is aware of what's going on. And Jerry, when you said 85% of the people in the world are religious, I don't know what that means. You know, what does religion for me if I'm worshiping a rat, would I be a religious person? Or, you know, if I worship an idol, would I be the religious person? Or if I worship an unseen entity that has created everything, would I be a religious person? And also, there is a big saying that, you know, talk is cheap, put your money where your mouth is. I don't know the budget that you all have, both of you, to come back such a big, big, big mission. And so if the evil is not fed, the evil will die under its own weight. So your task is to find out who's feeding these people, ISIS or the Boko Harams or all the people in the world that they come in and saying certain things and cutting people's head and playing football with it in the name of something.
Okay. Response?
Thank you.
Just briefly about who is religious. There was a poll being done around the world. I think Pew Charitable Trust, maybe Templeton and others have looked at this. And it's mostly people who would self-describe as religious, so whether they're worshiping this or that is their business. And I'd add a point on that front that people who of no faith, the quote-unquote seculars or atheists, are also protected. There's it's important to keep the conversation that we don't create another we-they-ism that is being exploited in religious circles to say the secular West. You know, by polls, the United States is one of the more religious countries in the world, but it can be played as if we, you know, we just worship Hollywood and alcohol or other things. This idea of who is religious is an interesting question, but it's true that the majority of the world expresses itself and finds meaning in religion and religious practice and belief. I think that other question about money and resources is important, and how we are also building up this capacity inside the State Department to deploy expeditionarily people of religious literacy and diplomats who would be trained in this more thoroughly. So I think that's a resource question. And also starving off conflict, I do believe that, you know, there's that saying, you are what you become what you eat. So a lot of people are feeding conflicts from all around the world in sort of unbalanced diets. And it's a challenge for all of us to how to stave off and stem and contain conflict and counter some of those resources.
Right. Here, we'll have a lot of questions, so I think we'll take two at a time at this point. Here and here, Tom, and then we'll go back.
Ken Meyercord, World Docs. Before I ask my question, I'd like to make an aside concerning how the media sometimes creates misunderstanding on religion and hence hatred. And it concerns ISIS. I've seen reported that ISIS offers Christians the choice of conversion or death. I've also seen reported
flight
that
too.
Excuse me?
Flight also.
Or flight and flight. But I've also seen it reported that they're being offered conversion, death, or pay a tax.
Oh,
big difference. And a tax that goes back to the very first days of Islam concerning the people of the book. My question is, we've been engaged in a war on terror for a long time now. Do the so-called terrorists oppose us because of our religion?
Michael Lemon, retired Foreign Service, wanted to build back up on the diplomacy and religion conundrum, at least two aspects, perhaps three. One is, if as several of the panelists had noted, that conflicts frequently are struggles for power, influence, resources covered in theological garb or religion. How does American diplomacy in general take into account that conundrum as they seek to positively engage without being seen as making partisan choices among those contending parties? And that requires, it would seem to me, a great deal of knowledge that we don't always possess about what is the situational, on-the-ground lay of the players. The second is, in terms of any intervention on ourselves, the challenge of at times validating the narrative of the most extreme. We saw that in Iraq and we've seen it elsewhere. If you follow SITE or any of the services that monitor extremist websites, you will see words or actions on our part that are then used, exploited, to validate the narrative that they are seeking to advance. It can be from the standard sort of crusader Zionist collaboration, or in Iraq, it's the West seeking to protect minorities, be they Christians, Yazidi, or others, that then are exploited by ISIS or whomever.
That's the question, Mike.
No, well, the question is, how do you avoid these? How do you deal with them in reality as you seek to come up with specific diplomatic or policy initiatives to take that into account and to mitigate?
Okay, three questions. Terrorism, power politics, and amplification of, I guess, violent leaders. Right. Who would like to take a crack?
But I think in terrorism we've seen a whole litany of things to which terrorists object, and not all of them are religious. Some of those are colonial. Some of those are invasive, that is, sacred spaces being taken over or removed from their purview. Some of that is internal, that the monarchies don't do a good job governing us. So I think it's mixed, and I think that the coloration of religion is certainly part of it, and in some cases it may be the primary appeal in the field to the recruitment of new people to serve the cause. But each one of these, I think, is quite different, and each one of these deserves separate examination. And that gets to your second question, Mike, that we can put our foot in it if we don't understand how and in what way speaking can be either misinterpreted or misaligned to serve the cause. And we've had that. We had it all through the Cold War with the Soviets. So it isn't anything that's entirely new to American diplomats. It requires perhaps a new basis for understanding, and it requires a lot of reading, whether it's reading in the new media or reading the old media or a combination of both, to do that. And I think that's important. And it requires, obviously, a lot of language knowledge, all of which certainly we have tried to promote among American diplomats as a way to get the answer. And I think that the other question is, are they getting enough money to do this? And the answer is always no. How much more should they get? It depends upon their success, but I hope that the budget for the OIC mission and the budget for the Bureau of Stabilization includes a continued effort along these lines, because I think it makes a lot of sense and has a long way to go.
Okay. Let's take these three right here.
Thanks. Shirley Buzzard, Heartlands International. all of that you talked about is very impressive, but you haven't mentioned women at all, and all of the colleagues you talk about are women, are men, excuse me. So I wondered if you would talk about what initiative, if any, you're making to draw women into the whole thing, because they probably are the victims of some of this more than men.
Could you pass it, the lady in front of you, right here, in the blue?
Okay, my name is Harasi Bilso. I'm from Somalia. I'm from Alliance for Peace Building.
Could you hold it a little closer?
Hello?
There we go.
Yeah, my name is Harasi Bilso. I'm from Somalia. So I really like it, all the, you see, information is presented by the panel, and it's very important. But my question is, you see, it's very important that the dialogue between inter-religious leaders, but what I'm wondering is what will be the role for the youth? Because in my country, you see, it is the young people, maybe 18, 19, 20, who doesn't have enough knowledge. For example, in Islam, have been told something not true, and how can we afford them that they do not harm people based on the difference? Yeah. Thank you.
One more.
Hi, my name is Janet McGallagher. I served for years as a liaison between the Catholic Cardinal Zubair and the National Islamic Front in the Sudan, and was the spokesman for the peace talks, and then worked with DDR with the small arms survey there. So my question deals with some of what Ambassador Pickering talked about, and also Deputy Assistant Secretary White. Currently, the envoy to Sudan hasn't been, from the U.S., has not been allowed into Sudan because he refuses to meet with the president there. And I'm wondering if somebody like you, Ambassador, is it correct to call you Ambassador White?
No, just.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
That's why Jerry's fine.
Okay. Well, it's not bad to get a promotion, right? So, Jerry, would it be more valuable to have somebody like you go in because you're dealing with the JEM, the Justice and Equality Movement, which is a non-state actor, and maybe your expertise would be something that would help break things open again? And Ambassador Pickering, you talked about the fact that there have been so many NGOs or other influences that are domestic, because what I saw with the peace talks is that so many of the NGOs that had been dealing with the South Sudan problem and looking at the North-South things did it in terms of religion, and they just moved lock, stock, and barrel to Darfur. And that was actually a war over water and resources, and they've taken those same things. And I know how instrumental you have been in that and how influential you still are. And I'd love to hear how we could help what's going on in Sudan now. And maybe have somebody like Jerry's group go in, because I don't think, unless the presidential envoy agrees to meet with the president, that anything will ever happen.
Okay. We have, let's take this one, we'll take four. And
thank you very much. I'm Sarah Wolf. I'm a Fulbright scholar at the Transatlantic Academy, and I had two questions. The first one was also for Jerry, because you described this U-turn that happened in the State Department and in the practice of U.S. diplomacy. Do you think that the same is happening on the other side of the Atlantic? And I'm thinking about Europeans, where some countries like France actually have a theology themselves with secularism. So I was wondering if you had any transatlantic commonalities on that, especially maybe also with the European External Action Service, if you had any contacts. And this leads me to my second question. Drawing from, let's say, maybe European frilosity to engage with Islamist, especially political parties, is that President Moncef Marzouki was here in Washington last week, I think, and he denounced actually the fact that Western powers are letting down Tunisia precisely because Ennahda is such a big political force. And I could also raise the case of Egypt. So how is your bureau and also maybe coping with those realpolitik interests? Thank you.
We have a question about the role of women, about youth in Somalia, about Sudan and its many facets, coordination with Europe and Tunisia. Now, large of this, Jerry, falls to you. We'll just go down the line. I wish you would take this as sort of your final wrap-up, because we're about 5 minutes towards the end, and so we'll just go down the line. Jerry, Arsalan, Ambassador.
Because we have so many experienced people in the audience, it's clear that the questions are grounded in that experience, and you know some of the answers behind the questions, I would imagine. We need to do more, better, faster, and it's an urgent time for this issue. So I'd start maybe the overall thematic I'm thinking of, which our bureau has tried to exploit, is what does non-traditional or asymmetric diplomacy look like for such a time as this? Getting beyond some of the traditional diplomacy of, you know, there's a joke, but they were trying to overcome, you know, that the State Department sometimes uses 19th century tools and 20th century approaches, and we've got to be facing 21st century problems. So that's a criticism we take on board, where we try to upgrade all of our tools and our approaches. So non-traditional asymmetric diplomacy or expeditionary, people look even for the phraseology of how to describe doing diplomacy with civil society and others, or thematic envoys that aren't necessarily the ambassadors of the United States or Europe, who very often find themselves for security reasons behind fortresses and not getting to know the people. The people-to-people exchanges are withering. So this is a real challenge for our diplomacy in non-permissive environments. You just see that whether it's Syria or Libya, I mean, particularly in the Middle East and North Africa, an area that I probably know better than others. So in the case of the South Sudan envoy, I do agree with the intention that sometimes a top-level negotiating envoy is necessary but not sufficient, and there are political limitations on timing and courage, and at times you need to you know, send retired ambassadors as well as religious actors or non-governmental entities to help work. In that case, like a group like Sant'Egidio out of Rome has been doing a lot of peace work around the world behind the scenes. They're a good example of actually doing non-traditional diplomacy outside of the .gov or the public space. The role of women as well, it's a real challenge. Of course, in our bureau, you cannot be dealing with conflict around the world unless you have a gender strategy of inclusion and working with women leaders, like period, end of story. That said, when you get to the religious category, it tends to be, even on the interfaith circuit, a lot of men, patriarchal systems, running and getting engaged top down. So there must be another stream that actually uses more empowerment and capacity building for that level of leadership of women faith actors who are going to play a very important role on the world stage, but also locally. And youth, of course, same thing. You can't deal with these issues unless you're looking at the youth question. What's incentivizing them? Why is it so? What's the sex appeal of joining and being trained in violence, but also being rewarded for that? So it's like joining a gang, being rewarded, developing new skills, having courage and excitement, belonging, and then showed videos of why this is like heavenly reward when the religious messaging comes on board. And lastly, the question about sort of why do they hate us? The Americans are very often sort of wondering how we're being perceived. And I've heard it described that it really isn't about religion, although that is being the religification of politics is taking place, but it's the politics and the policies, these outstanding issues of what we're standing for consistently in the world. What about the two-state solution, the Arab-Israeli conflict that continues to fester as a cancer in the region, among many other things? This is a very challenging space to be working in as we move forward with a consistent foreign policy that's dynamic and not always as traditional as it used to look last century. So I'll close with that, saying we're doing our best on the innovative front, and we need more ideas and partnership with civil society and your thought leadership as well. So thank you so much for this time today.
Thank you. I do think the EU has started to take this into account as well, and we've worked with some people in the EEAS on their engagement both with the OIC and also with some of the Islamist parties in the Middle East and North Africa region. And if you want, I can talk to you afterwards and maybe share some contacts there. On the question about youth, I mean, that's absolutely critical, and Jerry was just getting to this about the recruitment, which goes back to the earlier question about validation and not validating the narrative from one side. A focus on youth is absolutely critical, and a lot of the countering violent extremism programs that the State Department implements focuses on kind of the younger population and focuses on countering the other narrative and avoiding validating the narrative. So part of not validating the narrative is, not to use certain terminology that certain groups might use. Like if someone calls themselves a jihadist, they mean to invoke their religion and saying this is a holy war. So we shouldn't call them a jihadist. We should just call them a terrorist or a violent extremist. And that's one thing that we've, our office has tried to do. Don't call them jihadists. They're not. They're terrorists. And also in terms of challenging the narrative and getting to youth, obviously a lot of the situation where these kind of ideologies can really gain hold, you have a lot of problems. I mean, you have kind of a breakdown of state institutions, including educational, economic, political. And so a lot of those underlying structural issues that allows violent extremism and those ideologies to take hold have to also be addressed. And education is absolutely one of those issues, including religious education. So it's not just secular education, it's also religious education. And that's one thing that we hear when we engage with religious scholars as well, that they, take these issues very to heart, and they feel it's their responsibility to correct a lot of the miseducation that's out there. And, that's certainly one thing that poses a challenge for the State Department, because we can't teach religion. We can't fund programs where someone is teaching a certain thing or anything like that. So it becomes a little bit more tricky in terms of the constitutional invisible handcuff. But that is absolutely an important role that civil society has to play and that the religious leaders themselves are playing and have to play.
We just have a minute or two. Tom, you have the final word.
Yeah, I know we're in overtime. I'll say just two things. I think as a matter of general rules,
And most rules in diplomacy have a few exceptions. This one has a few. But I think the notion that came out of the question of the woman who spoke so much about Sudan, that you demand a price for talking to somebody is one that's close to bankruptcy. That very rarely will people pay up front for the idea to talk about a solution to their problem with things that solve the problem in your direction, if I could put it that way. However, put it this way, outrageous an individual might be in their actions, if they are, in fact, on the other side and control an outcome, then you have to find a way to talk to them. And you may well be right in your suggestion, questioner, that using third channels, indirect channels, unofficial people can always play a useful role. Similarly, track two can. The second piece is also very much along that line. Years ago when I was at the United Nations, I urged the Secretary General to keep a list of individuals, former heads of state, former foreign ministers, that he, maybe someday she, can call upon to work in the behalf of the United Nations as unofficial or official representatives. That list now needs to have leading religious figures added to it. Similarly, Jerry and Arslan, I'd go back to Secretary Kerry and just say we're thinking about those people like Ted McCarrick, certain Muslim religious leaders in this country, the wonderful imam from Catholic University. That's certainly not meant to be an oxymoron. But others who could serve as individuals, who could relay messages, create understanding, build bridges, be part of what we would call the unofficial, but now much more employed, put it this way, universe of diplomacy. That we could use in that particular fashion. I think it makes a lot of sense. You know, retirees are fine, but maybe active individuals in their own area who know the problem very well from a religious angle ought to now be part of the official quotient in moving the question ahead.
Thank you. Thank you very much.